ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, Selena Green with you for The Country Hour today. Hello, and I hope you're having a wonderful Christmas Eve. Coming up today, how well is the Dairy Code doing its job? And we say a fond farewell to a man who's retiring after many decades in the wool game. He'll look back at what's changed in the industry over his many years and his parting thoughts on what could be to come.
Scarcity of supply. So that's going to bring, I think, further increases from where we are now. But I can't see being another super cycle, not going up $2 or $3 or anything like that.
That is to come. Now, my talkback number today is 1300 160 222. The text line 0467 922 783. A text I missed yesterday. It came in just as the program wrapped up, so I didn't get a chance to read it, but it said, "Hi, Selena, just getting to harvest at Padthaway." So a very late start in parts of the southeast. This says, lost one day with a fire ban, 2 days with wet weather, 9.5 mils of rain on Sunday. Have a great Christmas with your family. Season's wishes, that's from the Burgers. Hello to you. Thank you very much for your text and a very Merry Christmas to you too. And I hope you have a safe and successful harvest getting underway there at Padthaway. I got some beautiful texts yesterday and some photos coming through on the text line from folks still out harvesting right up to Christmas. So I'd love it if you could keep that coming today, wherever you're listening in from, if you're in the header or on the ute, or maybe you've already clocked off for Christmas and you've got your feet up. It's just lovely to hear from you, see where you are and know where you're listening from. So those numbers again, if you'd like to get in touch, 1300 160 222, the text line 0467 922 783. First today, let's go with the dairy industry. And after its second official review by the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, the Dairy Code is reportedly operating as intended. Now, the code was introduced back in 2020 as a mandatory code of conduct to fix significant imbalances in bargaining power between large dairy processors and dairy farmers. It ensures more transparent contracts, banning retrospective price cuts and providing better dispute resolution for the industry. Now, overall, the review found the code was working, but also made several recommendations to provide farmers and processors greater flexibility when implementing it. Annie Brown spoke with the president of the Australian Dairy Farmers, Ben Bennett, about the review.
Absolutely, the dairy code's working. We have to remember why, due to naughty behaviour of the processors stepping down their milk price after what they'd agreed to pay us. And in the last nearly 8 years of it, it hasn't happened. So I think that's a big plus. It's an insurance policy. It doesn't determine the milk price, but it's an insurance policy to give a surety that the price that they say they're going to give us is the price that we do get for the duration of the season.
So to take it back a few steps, the code was introduced 5 years ago, and it was there to help level playing field and following on from when Australia's largest milk processor, Goulburn Murray, announced that it would slash farm gate milk prices to below the cost of production, and then Fonterra followed suit. That was 10 years ago now. I guess, can you take us back to that time and what it was like for dairy farmers?
Yeah. When back then, like I was formerly with Murray Goulburn, but they sort of started over-promising and they were getting sort of pretty cocky about things. And the price was quite strong relative to the international price. Fonterra had given warning signals that, hey, but they still pitched in at quite a strong price, but started to regret it. But that's what they gave, and that's how farmers went about the season to perform. And subsequently, the proverbial hit the fan, and Murray Goulburn was exposed for where it was, decided to renege on their price. Fonterra thought, well, we'll jump on the same bus. And, a lot of farmers, we're a high turnover, low margin industry. And when they hit us was in autumn, when our costs, and quite often, can supersede our income because we're setting up for the season. particularly for autumn domestic milk inclined farming.
So that was 10 years ago now. What have been some of the key changes that introducing this dairy code has made for dairy farmers?
When it happened, it left a phenomenally bitter taste in a lot of people's mouths. A lot of people got out of farming or shortly after that. And what this code has done is giving farmers a surety that naughty behaviour, there is legal regress against it. But it's all us very well saying, you know, on principle they shouldn't do this, but it needs a firm stick. That's what the code does. It gives that a surety, and that gives people the comfort to continue on farming, particularly in a high turnover, low margin industry.
So this review coming back saying that it's working, you know, that it's doing what it's meant to do, does that give farmers a lot of confidence going forward, do you think?
Well, Australian dairy farmers feels very much so. The process that of this review, we feel, was very good. The bureaucrats went through an extensive consultation process with representative entities. And if people want to hear their voice through the representative entities, they're sort of holding the reins. They did cast the net very wide. Other interested groups came along. Obviously, the processes also, they're very much integral in this. They spent their time doing it, and I think they were very thorough. And we actually commend them for that. We think that they held to the line pretty well. We're concerned about a few smaller issues that they've sort of given a bit of concession to the processes. But at the end of the day, it validates why we do have that code of conduct, to give farmers that confidence. And that's been a very big tick of acceptance.
There were also 8 recommendations from the review. So looking through them, a lot of them were about amending different paragraphs, engaging further with stakeholders. Was there anything in those recommendations that you would challenge or question?
Yeah, there were sort of 3 that we were sort of somewhat perplexed about, along with the ACCC, and one was the cooling off period. Okay, we feel the farmers need and deserve the opportunity just to ensure that heady time of the year, because we've only got one time of the year to make a significant decision on the income stream for our farm. Okay, they wanted that period shrunken from a fortnight down to about a week or so, and we were sort of against that. Like, if they were going to make a decision, they'll make a decision, and we just thought having that little bit of extra breathing time, reduce down the emotion of making a decision and giving them that comfort, I think is quite balanced. But that's where they landed on that. Another one is extraordinary circumstances. We're somewhat perplexed about that. We think it's a bit, there's a bit of an ambiguity about that and just what they're meaning. So that's sort of lost on us a little bit. So, and the other ones are just, they're quite tiny. But it's the old story, if you get into a legal challenge, those little incidentals, they get out there with a microscope. So, yeah.
That's the President of Australian Dairy Farmers, Ben Bennett, there speaking to Annie Brown about the second official review of the Dairy Code by the Department of Ag, Fisheries and Forestry. It's 13 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green today. Well, the wool market is in recess now until the 12th of January. And for one long-running wool market reporter, it's recess and retirement time. Well, for many years, Rod Miller from the Australian Wool Network has joined us on both the Country Hour and also our Rural Reports for wool market updates. But now he's hanging up his white coat. He was well known for wearing in the shearing sheds right across South Australia. So Brooke Neindorf caught up with Rod to find out what's been some of the biggest challenges he's seen in his 50 years in the industry. But she started off by asking what he expects for wool in 2026.
Buyers will be keen to resume because it's very clear to Chinese mills. Now, we talk about, I do, China a lot because, look, there's still 85% of our market. So what happens in China is very, very relevant to us in the wool market. They're very clear about, you know, the lack of supply. And you would have read where, certainly for us in South Australia, we are the worst affected by the drought period, which we've all survived through. So something like just under 14% drop in production in South Australia was the worst nationally as a region. So mills are acutely aware that the wool volumes are going to be very, very low.
What are you expecting for 2026? What do you think you'll be keeping an eye on, Rod?
Can't see any fundamental significant change other than that scarcity of supply. So that's going to bring, I think, further increases from where we are now. But I can't see being another super cycle, not going up $2 or $3 or anything like that. Again, we look at China. The data out of China. So China's investment fell for the third straight month in November, official data showed. So the decline is expecting calls from China's top leadership to stabilise investment in an economy that for decades has relied on state financing for growth. So they have deflation in their economy, so, and some quite significant social change. So that's not going to disappear in the 6 months of next year. So again, being 85% of the market, I think things will remain fairly similar to what they are now, except for the lower supply can help hold it up.
Now, Rod, after 13 years with the Australian Wool Network and 50 years in the industry, I believe, you've begun the transition into retirement. Now, what are your plans moving forward from here?
Yeah, that's exactly right, transition to retirement. I'm going to do this market analysis and reporting, which is a role I have internally for AWN and a number of key clients. So that's something that's come through doing my reports with you over many, many years, Brooke. It's something I enjoy doing. I like to search for global factors that affect the wool market. So I'm going to do more. They say if you do a job that you love, you don't feel like you're working. So that's been the situation for me. So I'll keep doing that. And so I'm still around if need be. But yes, I am transitioning to retirement. So we're doing about half a day a week, but I remain on call for a number of staff and a few clients.
And we might even get you on every now and again, Rod, just to see what your thoughts are on the wool market as well. But we won't make you get up early on a Monday morning like you have joined us for many years.
That's never been a problem. Yes, you should check in every now and again just to see if I'm not losing it. But it's also important for Tom Simmons, for Jared. I mean, those young men particularly do have good market analysis skills, and it's important too that they come to the fore within the industry in South Australia as well.
What have you loved about being involved in the wool industry, Rod?
Well, I was a bit fortunate. You know, when I left high school in Mount Gambier and started doing wool classing, working in the bulk class in Port Adelaide, that was 1975, I was fortunate that I really had an affinity for the wool classing and found a passion for the fibre, and that was by pure chance. I mean, really, I'd left school, I had to get a job, basically. So that took me through shearing sheds to my stencil, all through technical aspects of wool. I enjoyed my role as a wool auctioneer for many years in Adelaide while there were wool sales. Took me nationally managing wool stores all around Australia, and took me overseas where I always had a passion for understanding the full pipeline. So I did an amount of work around the world working with processors. So that was a connection I always enjoyed making.
And what are some of the biggest changes or challenges do you think that wool producers have faced since you've been involved in the industry? I mean, there's probably many there.
Oh, yeah, we look over 50 years. Clearly, the wool stockpile was the biggest one. It still might be today the biggest corporate collapse in Australia. Just the industry politics involved in that. But for me as a wool broker, it was auctioneering page after page to what was the Australian Wool Corporation, AWC. The wool buyers used to call out gummit, 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 as in government, knocking down pages. And then for a decade, seeing the pain, it really changed the landscape in South Australia. We look at the number of sheep stations in the Flinders Ranges, for example, that, you know, went into tourism and other ventures through necessity. It really changed the landscape, particularly in that area. And then for a decade involved with the storage and maintenance of those stockpile bales, and seeing, Brooke, at the end, where some of those wools were up to 12 years old. They had been super high density tri-packed, and when they didn't spring open, they took a little bit of opening at the scour. But when those wools processed, they were shorn a month before. It was magnificent for the fibre.
Do you think you'll still pop in a few shearing sheds here and there and call in and say good day?
They're old habits, and I used to really enjoy that, Brooke. And the other highlight of my career as a broker was not only my wool grower clients, but was the shearing teams, particularly the wool classes. I have a strong affinity with quite a few wool classes around the state, from the island right up north, and the shearing teams, contractors. And I always had, and I do, a high degree of respect for shearers and wool classes and people who work in a shearing shed environment. So not the easiest of work environments at times, but the level of professionalism of these teams, I think, was is a real strong point for the industry, and good on them. And a number of my Kiwi friends involved there. There were some sheds I didn't get to, and I had a couple of wool classes ring me and said, "Rod, why didn't you come? And we missed you." Another one said, "Rod, we miss seeing you in your white coat in the shed."
That's Rod Miller from the Australian Wool Network speaking there with Brooke Neindorf about his retirement. And we do thank Rod and all the wool market reporters that join us every Monday morning, nice and early, to bring us the wool market results across the whole state.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
Every year's different.
The Country Hour.
It's about connecting with people.
Part of your community for 80 years.
Beautiful.
Weekdays at noon on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
When I first joined in November of 1964, the first shots were being fired in the move to introduce the reserve price scheme in wool. You remember that, well, you mightn't, but people were sort of arguing across fence lines. Families were split by the decisions that people were making, and it was really a hard time for the wool grower. Well, I, as a young man, was a bit confused by this, but anyway, we went along with it. As you know, it lasted until about 1990 when we saw it fall over at Roma.
That's the late Colin Munro, former head of the ABC Rural Department, reflecting on the rise and fall of the wool floor price. Hello, I'm Annie Brown, and this year the Country Hour marks 80 years since it first went to air on ABC Radio on December 3rd, 1945. Let's head back to the 1970s. It was a turbulent time for Australian farmers, with many markets down. But for struggling wool growers, it was a time of change. In 1974, the much-debated wool floor price was introduced. The Australian Wool Reserve Price Scheme was set up to smooth out fluctuations in the market and give producers a minimum price for their wool. This is a report for the Country Hour by John Parker in 1974.
There's no doubt that most growers agree that there's a need for a floor price to be announced. The two organisations who claim to represent all of Australia's wool growers, the AWMPF and the AWGC, have both said they want an announced floor price and that it should be 300 cents a kilo for 21 micron wool. They won't accept anything less, and they think it should be announced before the new season. The feeling generally among wool growers could be summed up in this comment from New South Wales wool grower David Hodgkinson.
I think that the sooner they make it and end the uncertainty in the industry, the better, both from the overseas buyer's point of view and from ours.
What would happen, do you think, if they don't?
Well, I think that we'll see a repeat of the early 1970s, where you'll see sheep being sold off and the Australian wool clip going down again very rapidly.
Do you think growers generally would welcome some government announcement on a reserve price?
I'm sure that they would welcome it, and I'm sure that it would be good for Australia in the long run, because I'm quite sure that the government would make a profit on whatever the price they put in.
It seems that all agree then there should be announced floor price. The difficulty is, who should announce it, the government or the corporation? Whether a floor price is set or not depends on the government, but will it work? The chairman of Economic Wool Producers, Mr. Jim Maple Brown, told us that for a fixed floor price to operate, the government would need to hold 5 to 10 million bales of wool, and it would cost about $2,000 million to operate.
The government did come on board, and the scheme operated for 17 years. However, it was abandoned in 1991 despite protests from producers who wanted to keep it. In short, it led to a massive, unsellable stockpile of wool, and the Australian Wool Corporation went broke trying to maintain the price. At the time, the AWC had 4.6 million bales of wool and a net debt of $2.4 billion. It was often referred to by the media as the Wool Mountain. This is then Minister for Primary Industries John Kerin speaking to the ABC in 1991.
You said earlier today it was your most difficult decision ever. How difficult?
Oh, very. This is the Holy Grail. The reserve price scheme's been there 17 years. This came about as a result of a very bitter debate in the 1960s. This is a very tough decision.
And will this decision work this time, do you think?
Yes.
Over what period? 5 years?
Well, that's the idea.
And what will have happened to your average wool grower's income over that period of time?
They are not going to have very good incomes over this period. I believe they'll have better incomes than they would have if they tried to stay and continue to buy their own wool and try and set a price that the market had walked away from.
In the aftermath, many wool producers left the industry. And in 2025, it was predicted Australian wool production would fall to its lowest level in more than 100 years. Today, prices fluctuate based on market conditions, primarily driven by demand from China. China is the world's largest wool processing country, receiving about 85% of Australia's wool. Celebrating 80 years of rural stories on the Country Hour, I'm Annie Brown.
And thanks, Annie, for that wonderful trip. Well, a trip down memory lane. Maybe not so wonderful for some, but yeah, very interesting to look back on some of the history of these big stories that the Country Hour has covered in its 80 years, which we're now celebrating. 3rd of December was our official birthday. So we'll, I think take the opportunity to celebrate 80 years of the Country Hour all throughout next year, and being Australia's longest continuous running radio program, certainly a reason for celebration. Also celebrating Rod Miller today as he's hanging up his white coat after 50 years in the wool industry. But I had a great text that's just come through about another retirement that we should acknowledge. This text reads, wishing a very happy retirement to Shane Kelly, who's today finishing up at Kelly Tillage, formerly known as Kelly Engineering, after nearly 24 years and a lifetime dedicated to sustainable agriculture. A passionate leader to a nearly 40-year-old business based in the mid-north town of Boolaroo Centre. While his involvement with the business will likely never fully end, it's time for a well-earned break. So congratulations to Shane on a great career and happy retirement to you. But imagine like Rod maybe that you'll be hard to get rid of and you'll still be popping your head in from time to time to see how things are going. But hope you enjoy your retirement. Well-deserved. That text line is 0467 922-783.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Selena Green with you today on The Country Hour. It's time to head to the Weather Bureau, and Lincoln Trainer is our forecaster again today. Hi, Lincoln.
Good afternoon, Selena. How are you going?
Very good. What is the big story with the weather on this Christmas Eve?
Well, there's not too many big stories. Right now, I'm looking at satellite picture. The clouds clearing along the southern agricultural areas. A little bit of cloud in the southeast. I do see a little bit of dust blowing to the north of the northeast pastoral district. So that's interesting. A little bit of a southerly there. Apart from that, in terms of warnings, we've got a marine warning. That's the only warning we have. One for the Spencer Gulf, strong winds, and some strong winds elsewhere along the coast. For today and, you know, Christmas Eve, moving into Christmas Day, it's mostly settled. We're expecting a mostly dry day today and during Christmas, cool to mild in the south, warm to hot in the north. There is heat building late in the week and the weekend with increasing fire danger. So they're the key messages. But if we kind of dig in a little bit deeper, we'll go through the story. For Wednesday, today, Christmas Eve, there is a ridge of high pressure extending across the west. This high pressure system is moving eastwards to be centred south of the Bight by tonight. And that's going to bring a dry day with that cloud clearing, maximum temperatures near to below average, and south to southeasterly winds, which are fresh at times we're seeing at the moment, but mainly settled. And then for Christmas Day, this high pressure system's moving to the south of South Australia. As it moves slowly east, it's going to be dry and mostly sunny throughout for South Australia on Christmas Day. Maximum temperatures near to below average, south to southeasterly winds, fresh at times with some afternoon sea breezes if you're near the coast. For Friday, the high pressure system is going to continue to move eastwards to be centred just west of Tasmania as a cold front begins to move into the Bight. It's going to be dry and mostly sunny for Boxing Day. Maximum temperatures near to below average in the east, tending above average in the west. We're starting to see that heat build. Southeasterly to northeast to northeasterly winds, fresh at times near the coasts. Then as we move into the weekend, high pressure system continues to move eastwards, and it's going to be dry and sunny for Saturday and Sunday. So pretty settled with some heat building on the weekend, Selena.
All right. And yeah, like as we established yesterday, really, as far as rainfall goes, we don't really, well, there's really nothing really to report there in the short term for accumulative rainfall.
Yeah, accumulative rainfall is dry, zero.
All right. Well, we'll see what the new year brings. Thanks for that, Lincoln.
No problem, Flynn, and happy birthday to the Country Hour.
Thank you very much, Lincoln Trader there from the Weather Bureau with your Christmas Eve and Christmas Day and Boxing Day forecast. But yeah, dry is the forecast. It is 12:30. Just letting you know what the forecast is for the western inland parts of New South Wales for Christmas Day. For the upper western district, sunny with southerly winds, 25 to 40 k's an hour. Overnight temperatures between 17 and 21. Daytime temperatures between 30 and 35 degrees. For the lower western district, also sunny with southerly winds, 15 to 25 k's an hour, picking up to 25 to 35 k's an hour in the morning. Overnight between 11 and 16 during the day in the high 20s.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, coming up, a pre-Christmas check-in with a local oyster grower and one of our outback stations. Also, is every brandy on your table tomorrow or maybe in your Christmas pudding? A South Australian family has been distilling brandy for a century in 2025, and you'll hear from them before this hour is up.
I think there's something like 500 flavour compounds in really good quality brandy, and there's something like 800 flavour compounds in good quality chocolate. And so you put those two together and you've got just a mouthful of absolute delightful flavours.
But first, we need to get to news headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, police say they've found explosive detonators, three unregistered firearms, a crossbow, swords, knives and a trafficable quantity of cannabis at a property at Dublin on the Adelaide Plains. SAPOL's bomb technicians were called to secure the detonators and the guns have been seized. A 37-year-old man has been arrested and charged with firearm and weapons offences and drug trafficking. A passenger on a flight that made an unexpected diversion to Adelaide this morning says people became panicked when the flight crew quickly prepared for landing. Qantas says QF36 from Singapore to Melbourne landed normally at Adelaide Airport due to a technical issue. It was not an emergency nor a priority landing. Passengers have been put onto other flights. And a seafood seller at Adelaide Central Market says despite some customers feeling cautious about buying seafood, he still anticipates Christmas Eve to be their busiest day of the year. Much of South Australia coastline has been affected by the algal bloom this year, which has caused dead marine life to wash up on metropolitan and regional beaches. David Gill from Angelakis Brothers Seafood says that SA prawns, garfish and flathead have all been popular so far this Christmas season. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, as you heard there, the lead up to Christmas, it has meant our seafood industry is absolutely flat out trying to keep up with demand. Yesterday, we did hear from some busy prawn sellers. Today, as you heard there, fish, prawns, mussels, rock lobster, oysters, they're all going to be flying out the door as everyone gets their last minute fresh seafood. Not everyone, though, is able to benefit from this year's Christmas bonanza. While many oyster growers do remain open for business here in South Australia, we must acknowledge that for some, still closed because of this harmful algal bloom, it is a Christmas of missed opportunity. One of those is York Peninsula's Pacific Estate Oysters, which has been closed for most of this year now. Its owner is Steve Bowley. Steve, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, everyone's probably out rushing to buy their last-minute Christmas seafood today, but for you and for your business and other oyster growers around your area, you're still closed, unfortunately?
Yes, day 233 of our closure today, so that's coming up on 8 months that we've not been able to sell an oyster or move an oyster for that matter. So, yes, Christmas this year in 2025 has passed us by. So, yeah, it's been a different kind of take on Christmas this year. Normally it is flat out, but yeah, Not this year.
Because I was going to ask, normally, you know, Christmas Eve or the few days leading up to Christmas, what would it normally in a good year, a usual year, be like for you?
Oh, look, it's, as I said, flat out. We would make a significant amount of money over the weeks leading up to Christmas particularly. And the phones have been running off the hook. It continues to amaze us that people, despite the publicity that the harmful algal bloom's been getting, really, a lot of people don't know about it. The phones are still ringing. People still want to order oysters for Christmas and New Year. Unfortunately, it can't be from us. But there are lots of oysters in the market, those coming from the West Coast, and we would encourage consumers to continue to buy South Australian seafood, including oysters. When they see them in the markets, they're safe to eat, they're fine, and enjoy them.
Yeah, we want people to keep buying, keep supporting those who are able to open. Does that give you heart, though, Steve, if people are calling and inquiring, does that give you some heart that when you are able to reopen that people are keen to get back in there and buy your oysters?
Yes, it does. It has been very gratifying that people are supporting us and, you know, sending us their best wishes and sending us messages on Instagram and, you know, social media generally saying, hey, can't wait till you're back in the market. So that is good to know.
What's the latest update that you've had? Has there been any sort of hope that this reopening might happen anytime soon?
It might. We, in fact, had a Zoom meeting or Teams meeting with PERS this morning. We've got to have decreasing Karenia in the water, and we've got to have below the threshold for the brevetoxin, and we've got to have 2 weeks of that, so 1 week apart, two tests 1 week apart. We've got 1 week, and the next week is due on Monday, I reckon. So we just had a bit of a meeting this morning about what's likely to happen, because what we don't want to do, and what happened at Kangaroo Island, American River, when they reopened, they then, a few days later, closed again when, you know, the brevetoxin level spiked, and so it goes. In fact, they've been closed a couple of times, having reopened and then closed. So that's not such a good thing, because food safety, we've got to recall all that stock that's in the market. So I think we're going to call it and say, well, we're not likely to sell before the new year. And so we'll just hold off a couple more weeks to see, to make sure that the brevetoxin levels, if they do go down, stay down, so that we can sell and get back into the market from then on.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a cost to us to start marketing, and if we sell stuff and then have to have it come back, that's not a good thing either. So,
So it's a little bit of work too. And like you say, you want to be sure, because that would be, you know, you don't want to add that to your plate to have to recall products.
No.
So you want to be sure if you're sending it out that you're good to keep up to keep going once you've got that ball rolling.
Yes,
to keep it rolling. Yeah.
Yes. Otherwise, it's death by a thousand cuts, really, isn't it? Mm. You know, to open then close and open and close again. So yeah, once the ball starts, it starts rolling, we want to keep it rolling.
Well, I hope it starts rolling for you and the rest of the growers in the area who, as you say, it's been a long time. Hopefully
it
it's not too much longer, Steve, and we can chat to you about some much better news in 2026.
Thanks, Selena. We're looking forward to 2026, hoping it's a much better year.
Absolutely. Well, have a Merry Christmas, and thanks so much for joining
us. Thanks, you too. Bye for now.
Steve Bowley there from Pacific Estate Oysters. If you are heading out to buy your seafood this summer, do support our South Australian oyster and seafood operators who are able to sell. And we hope all of those who are still closed are back up and going very, very soon. It's 22 minutes to one.
Pete's at his mother-in-law's fourth wedding. But thanks to a discreetly placed earbud in the ABC Listen app, he's also at the Ashes.
Don't let life get in the way of cricket. Catch every ball this summer live and ad-free on the ABC Listen app.
Well, let's head out now to the edge of the South Australian outback, where things have been pretty dry again this year. Yesterday on the program, we heard from some graziers in outback New South Wales who received some very welcome weekend rain just ahead of Christmas. While some did fall also over parts of the pastoral district, it's not made as much of a dent. Mary Lou Bishop is from Quandong Station. That's about 165 clicks northeast of Burra. And it's a working merino sheep station covering 365,000 acres, or just shy of 1,500 square kilometres. Let's see how the year's been there. Mary Lou, it's lovely to have you on the country and welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I thought we'd check in, head to the outback and see how things have been in the lead up to Christmas. I know there was a little bit of rain out your way over this past weekend. Did you happen to get any at the station?
Very, very little. We got 18 mils at the homestead, and that was basically it. None of our dams filled, none of our drains ran. We've been busy during the year cleaning out dams to enable us, when the rains come, to carry water, a lot of water. We like to think that we carry 3 years' worth of water on the station, but we've got only 5 dams with water in them of 42. So that's how dire it is out there.
Right, so 18 mils, it's not going to make really much of a difference, unfortunately. So it's been a pretty significant, another significantly dry year. I imagine 2024 was a pretty dry one as well.
Very. We've only had about a half of our annual rainfall. Our annual rainfall is 235 mils or 8 inches, just over 8 inches a year. And that we've had 4 inches effectively, which is really, really low. It's the third driest year at the station in the 23 years that we have owned the station.
So that's
the driest year was 2019. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So 2019 and then, another couple of very dry ones. So, significantly dry period that you've sort of had to manage through. What's that meant? Obviously, you're working sheep station. So what's that meant for the year? That's obviously been something you've had to work through. Have you down, reduced your flock or what did you do to get through the year?
Well, we haven't yet, but the issue for us is that we are still pulling out of the 2019 drought, and we've really struggled to get our flock back up to a viable flock. We're wool producers, so we need about 14,000 sheep to be viable, and at the moment we've 8,750. We've stalled and we cannot seem to get it any greater than that. Our lambing was really bad this year, but it was bad right across the northeast pastoral. I blame the number of goats that we're carrying. We estimate we have between 20 and 24,000 goats on the station at any one time, which is horrific because 60% of goats are male, are billies, and a billy will eat 2.4 DSC, eat as much as a ram, but we've only got 130 rams on this property and we've got 12,000 billy goats. So you could imagine the impact on our environment. And the other issue is we control our breeding with our merinos. They have one lamb a year. The goats have 1.7 kids 1.7 times a year.
Wow.
So it's the impact of the goats in Western New South Wales and the Northeast Pastoral and now into the Flinders is horrific.
Yeah, so they'd just be, in those numbers, they'd just be chomping through everything in sight.
They do. And they are now entering into the gardens because it's dry and we have the garden around the homestead is reticulated water. The goats are heading in there and devastating the homestead garden.
I imagine that's something you've put a lot of love and care and time into building up, I can only imagine.
I've created a monster up there, absolute monster, in that whenever I'm at the station, because we share our time between Adelaide and Quandong, I garden. I'm always gardening. I've got an orchard, I've got a succulent garden, I've got a native garden, and I've got a Mediterranean garden. All have different water requirements. And the idea is that when it gets really bad, which is what it is at the moment, only the orchard and the Mediterranean garden that is at place of peace and tranquility up there get water, but even they may have to miss out if we don't get water shortly.
Marina, what are your options for getting on top of the goats? I mean, that's a huge battle at your doorstep.
It is huge. We have shifted off thousands and thousands this year, and we're not alone up there. We'll be starting goating again in the beginning of January. We goat when we're mustering. So we will be mustering sheep because we will be shearing at the end of January. So they come in, and in this dry period, we can collect the goats on the water. So we have been, during this year, fencing off all our dam squares. And of those dam squares, we fence off a water square. And therefore, the goats and the sheep can't casually get to the water. The water is controlled. So we fill the stock troughs and the goats come in, as do the sheep. And when we're mustering, we have finger traps and the goats and the sheep go in and can't come back out again. So the guys go around in with the trucks in the morning and in the evening, sort the sheep and the goats out, bring the goats back into a holding paddock. And then once I've got 1,000 goats, they ring the trucks and the trucks come and collect them and they're off to the abattoirs.
Right, and then I guess repeat.
And
that,
repeat.
That process.
And
yeah.
It's more than just that. The goats have to be sorted out when they come in. So they are divided between the billies and the nannies. You cannot put them on the same truck. you just can't put them on the same truck. I'm not going any further on that.
Yep. I think we can figure that one out.
Yes. And then the big issue for us, though, of course, is the undersized goats, because it's illegal in South Australia once a goat has been mustered to release them. But there is no market for a goat under 15 kilos. And when they come in, they're still dropping kids in the holding yards. Goats everywhere.
Right, so aside from dealing with this and being overrun by goats and the fact that you haven't got any rain, we should obviously mention that.
Or water. And
the goats drink the water. And it hasn't been also a great year for your wool prices as well, for those, you know, in the wool game.
No, it hasn't. But we are courageous, crazy, brave. I'm not quite sure what to say about it. We do not mules our sheep. So we're out on a sort of out on our own out in the northeast pastoral, not mulesing, and we do get a premium for our wool, and a significant premium. So it has been really worth the challenge and all that we have learnt in going non-mulesing out in the pastoral country. We've also had out there Deakin University 2 years in a row, and they have just left the station, and they are studying fly strike, and they have, it's evolving that a bacteria on the sheep gives off a pheromone, and the flies are attracted to that bacteria. So they haven't gone so far as yet to work out whether only some sheep carry that bacteria or where that bacteria comes from. But they understand that certain bacteria attract that fly, because some flocks are less affected than other flocks. So that's some really interesting research that's coming out. It's sponsored by AWI, and we're one of the stations or the farms that are involved.
Fantastic. So that decision to, you know, go into non-mulesing, obviously that would have been a bit of a leap of faith some years back that is now paying off.
It was the last drought, to be honest. We were right down. We were carrying maybe 3,000 really dreadful-looking sheep and very few rams. And our then-manager said to us, let's stop mulesing. Let's change the genetics in our sheep. Let's go and get some SRS smooth-rolling, soft-rolling skinned rams and start afresh, and that's what we've done. So all our ewes now are carrying those genetics, the SRS genetics, and we can see less fly strike. And most of the people who are carrying those genetics can see less fly strike. So it's the sheep are very plain bodied. They don't have those traditional great big rolls of fat or skin. They don't have a big skin area. But where we catch up by not having a big skin area on our sheep is that the wool follicle density is greater than in an average merino. So it's a quite a different breeding program. And you would be foolish to just say, oh, I'm going to stop mulesing and carry on with your traditional merino rams. You've got to look into it quite deeply, which we did, and I don't think we have made a mistake, but we're only 5 years down the track.
Well, hopefully that continues to pay out for you in into 2026, and that those rains arrive, and you know you're able to keep chipping away at that goat issue. Coming into Christmas, we're Christmas Eve, but you take as a well deserved break away from the station.
Thank you so
over
much.
The Christmas period. Is that right?
Yes. Well, we'll be heading up there for New Year, and I don't know what the weather's going to be like. But it will be fun. We've got some Adelaide friends coming up, so it will be an adventure for them and fun for us.
Do you get many visitors coming over, you know, into the summer period to stay at the station as well?
No, we don't. We're always open for anybody who's brave enough to head out in that area. We're not the Flinders Rangers, and so the average tourist doesn't head out into the North East Pastoral, and especially when they hear it's 165 k's of dirt road and 23 stock grids, that really sorts them out.
Yeah. But, it's not the casual traveller dropping by to experience station life.
It's not a let's do this on a Sunday drive adventure, that one, but it's a very beautiful part of South Australia that not a lot of people visit. And we are right at the top of a run of conservation parks from the Murray. So you go Colpram and Gluepot. North of that is Chowella. North of that is Dangali. North of that is us. So we've got this fabulous run of conservation parks, and so our bottom paddocks are just like the conservation parks, really beautiful, heavily wooded, which surprises people. They think we're out there in a desert. We're not. Wonderful mallee forests.
Well, Mary Lou, it sounds beautiful. Maybe I'll be lucky enough to get out there one day, but wishing you and the family and everyone a safe and happy Christmas and a wonderful new year, and I hope 2026, you know, brings some better news
rain,
for you.
Rain. Yes. That's all I want is rain. Thank you.
Lovely to speak to you.
Happy Christmas to everybody else. Thank you.
Mary Lou Bishop there from Kwandong Station, northeast of Burra. It is just going on 1:08.
Power outages can occur anytime and could last hours, days, or even weeks. Find a handy guide on how to deal with power outages on the ABC Emergency website, ABC Radio.
Now, unfortunately, I've just been alerted by South Australian Police of a serious crash on the Dukes Highway here in South Australia. So if you are anyone travelling or planning to travel along the Dukes Highway around the Tintinara area, just be aware that you may have to find an alternative route because sections of the Dukes Highway have been closed. So we have police and emergency services responding to a serious crash on the Dukes Highway at Culburra. That's about 12 kilometres northwest of Tintinara. Crews were called to the scene there just after noon today after reports of a car colliding with a tree. There are major crash officers on their way to the scene. So the road is closed and police say that delays are anticipated. So there's a northbound detour via Woodswell Road to Princess Highway and Tailem Bend, and then a southbound detour via McIntosh Way via Princess Highway to Woodswell Road. So if you are planning on travelling along the Dukes Highway today, just be aware that there are road closures that may be ongoing there around the Tintinara area. So find an alternative route and please you know, make allowances for extra travelling time as well. Travel safe. Everyone plan ahead.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, is there going to be some brandy on your table tomorrow? It's a big at Christmas time brandy. I'm thinking your traditional pudding served with brandy butter or brandy sauce. Lots of ways you can use it. Well, one iconic Australian brandy label is actually celebrating its 100th distilling season this year, making it Australia's oldest family-run distillery. St. Agnes Distillery is still making brandy in the original copper stills at their Renmark site in the Riverland. St. Agnes Joint Manager Managing Director Richard Angove says the production process hasn't changed much in the past century.
You know, it's one of those things that there's no shortcuts in making brandy. It takes time and it takes patience and some serious craft as well.
This time of year, I'm thinking people are, you know, putting brandy into their Christmas puddings or maybe their brandy snaps. Is this a particularly busy time of the year for sales?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I hope that anyone making a Christmas pudding is putting a splash of St. Agnes brandy into it, and as well as those, you know, beautiful side dishes like your brandy butters, and then there's also the classic Christmas cocktail, the Brandy Alexander, and then a not-so-classic cocktail, but a lovely, refreshing, almost summer sort of cocktail, the Sidecar, which is a citrus-inspired sort of brandy-based cocktail. So a versatile product this time of year.
Yeah, lots you could do with it, as you say. Has it changed much from what, you know, people would have been drinking coming out of the distillery 100 years ago to today? I mean, has there been much of a tweak in what you're putting out?
I think consistency with our product has always stayed very much true to the way that we make our brandy. But I think people are certainly looking, rather than, say, the Brandy Alexander, which is a rich sort of creamy, chocolatey cocktail, a lot of people are looking for that more fresher, more vibrant cocktails. So that's where the Sidecar comes in, which is sort of lemon juice, Contro and St. Agnes brandy. And it just is, and you know, here in Australia in Christmas time, it's often quite hot. So that sort of fresh, cool cocktail is sort of becoming a little bit more fashionable.
The history of the distillery, obviously you're up to a number of generations now, but its beginnings, obviously these are, it's part of, as we say, South Australian history, but very much part of your family's history.
Yes, absolutely. So the first stills were actually put in Renmark in 1911, but it wasn't until 1925 when a gentleman by the name of Ron Hazelgrove, who was our distiller at the time, went to Cognac and learnt how they were making brandy and cognac, and came back and changed the way that we were making our brandy in 1925, and that's why we sort of celebrate the beginning of the St. Agnes Distillery as being 1925. And since then, we really haven't changed our production process at all. It's very traditional. It's sort of, you know, really focus on quality. And then there's the aging component of it, which is a lot of barrels sitting quietly in our barrel halls, quietly maturing the spirit and developing flavour and developing character. And consistency, I think, is really important, and that's that patience where, you know, you're distilling today to make a product that you're going to be selling in 30 or 40 years' time.
Mm. And that's, a leap when you're leaping into something that you know isn't going to be ready to go to the market for quite some considerable time. Obviously, this year we've talked a lot about trends in consumption, particularly with the wine industry is feeling it. Is brandy one of those ones that sort of comes in and out of fashion? Does it go in trends of whether people are consuming it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's quite a mature market. I often think that there's a brandy gene that goes off in people. When you sort of turn about 40 or 50 years old, you discover that brandy is a spirit of your repertoire, but certainly we've seen very consistent sales and an increase in sales in our particularly our XO brandies, so our 15-year-old, 20-year-old, 40-year-old, and we just released a 50-year-old XO this year to celebrate the 100-year anniversary. In that sort of XO luxury category, there's been some really nice growth, which is good, and we're very fortunate to have a very loyal consumer group that are very, you know, I think people want to trust brands that have provenance and that have been around for a while and the consistent quality that we deliver. So we've got a really good base of loyal consumers.
100 years under the belt. So what is the future looking like?
I'd go back to consistency. So we want to continue to build stock because we need to be patient and plan for the future. And I guess that's, you know, we're five generations in the family business, and we're certainly looking out for the sixth and the seventh. And that was one of the things my grandfather did, was just every year commit to producing stock and putting it away, and that'll give future generations the opportunity to blend and bottle aged spirits, because our 50-year-old XO was distilled in 1970, 1971, and I wasn't even born then. My dad was 23 years old, and it was just, you know, that foresight of my grandfather to say, you know, this is stock that we're going to make. And we'll be selling it in sort of 50 years' time. So we're certainly planning on continuing to build our stocks and produce exceptional brandy here in South Australia.
So there'll be a bit of brandy on the table for Christmas in the family this year?
Always, yes. The thing I love about brandy is the flavour and the way it accompanies chocolate. So chocolate and XO brandy go really, really well together. I think there's something like 500 flavour compounds in really good quality brandy, and there's something like 800 flavour compounds in good quality chocolate. And so you put those two together and you've got just a mouthful of absolute delightful flavour. So we'll have some XO on the table for sure.
Richard Angove, their joint managing director at St Agnes Distillery in the Riverland, which in 2025 has been celebrating its 100th distilling season. That's it for me. A quick hello to Mary and Heine, who are in Compton, Mount Gambier area. They texted in to say Merry Christmas, Selena and family, and to all the listeners of our ABC Country Hour. Thanks so much, Heine and Mary. Merry Christmas to you too. Merry Christmas to all of our wonderful listeners of the Country Hour. I hope you have a safe and happy Christmas and Boxing Day. And I will be back with you on Monday. That will be your next edition of the Country Hour at noon. So, yeah, have a wonderful Christmas, and I will catch you then. It's just coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.